As we're waiting, maybe for some people to join, Kathy, where are you beaming in from today?
I'm beaming in from the botanical gardens at the University of Manchester, which are really lovely, because I'm preparing to do some listening walks here with some people at the university. So there's all kinds of research going on here, and there's ponds, there's compost heaps, there's sphagnum moss. I can't wait to get my microphones in the compost heap, to be honest. And they've got different microbiomes and greenhouses with different sort of climates to grow different plants. And I think they're, yeah, experimental environmental science is happening.
Brill. Great,
Where are you
great.
beaming in from, Teresa?
I'm beaming in from Brazil, São Paulo. Yes, from the living room of my mate's house. Okay, I think we will start. So for those who might have joined and missed the introduction, this series is part of the hybrid conversations that we're hosting with Kubu Cultural House Bogota in Finland. Kubu is a former schoolhouse, over 100 years old, that has been transformed into a new cultural arts centre for the island of Kemiotone. Since last year, we have been working with Kubu, creating the elemental program. The elemental program takes the elements as a starting point for a series of interrelated works. Last year, we had the sort of year of the earth. This year, it's water. Next year, it's air. Then, followed by metal, ether, and wood. Excuse me, bringing us up to 2030. So, for anybody that's interested and curious about what we're doing, do keep in touch, as there's loads of little things that are possible in terms of working with us or connecting with us. I'm delighted that as part of this month's hybrid conversation, we're speaking to Kathy Hind, artist, composer, musician, instrument maker, who I can basically say have the privilege to know for almost 2 decades, having collaborated with Kathy on various different projects over the years as well. But central to Kathy's work has been a focus on water. And we were just before the recording started, actually, I would say she's been working with water since the 90s, we figured in some ways it has been a very key feature in terms of her practice. Today we'll be focusing on some of her kind of more contemporary and recent works, but specifically also around forms of listening to water and water bodies that Kathy has been engaging with, both in terms of her instrument making practice as well as her experiments with horns and phone and microphones and many other things, which we'll get into. But Kathy, before I sort of get into the details, some of the methodological details of your work, shall we say, how your work is characterized by an engagement with, I would say, sensing practice, environmental sensing practice, particularly around migration patterns, data, water bodies. How did you get into this form of working, and what kind of brought those configurations to the fore in your work?
Well, firstly, thank you very much for inviting me. It's great to be here. So I guess there's a couple of things I can think of. Firstly, I've always had a very cross-disciplinary practice. So I did a combined arts degree in across visual art and music, and I've always been really interested in bringing different disciplines together. But wider than that, I'm really interested in, working with scientists or other kind of collaborative practices with people in different fields, and the more than human world as well. But sort of thinking to sort of the crux of it, I think there is a, this fascination with sound and unusual sounds, which has kind of, I was always very interested in field recording. And then this led to sort of trying to discover ways of listening to sounds we can't usually hear and thinking about, what is it like to listen from the perspective of a species living in the water, for instance, like, so to listen underwater and to sort of imagine what that other world is like. And I think this is, expanded to, just like the fa a fascination with how other species sense and the kind of, you know, what does that reveal? And you know, just by engaging with some of these imaginative ways of potentially listening from another perspective, it kind of opens up your own sensing and imagination and way of being in the world that that changes. And I think from, you know, spending really long amounts of time listening or bird watching or trying to film a flock of geese taking off at 4 a.m, having traipsed through, you know, somewhere in the middle of the night, all of those encounters and ways of being have like really, really impacted me and my relationship with the natural world. And I think through the work that I make, I kind of want to bring some of those fascinations and sort of shifts in perspective or ways of thinking or imagining to sort of spark that in other people. So I think, yeah, it's those kinds of fascinations. And I think those sorts of fascinations have led me to sort of seek out ways of having conversations with, you know, scientists who research these very specific fields like magnetic sensing or bioacoustics, just because I find that, you know, really, really inspiring as sort of food for imaginative, creative work. And then I guess the other... Oh, sorry.
No, go on. I was just going to... You go.
I did say stop me if I go on too long. But also, I think there's another thing that is going on, and that is my interest in emergent behaviour. So thinking way back to kind of like music ensembles, playing with other people and those sorts of ways of having some simple rules that create complex behaviours and ways of improvising or open scores or... So thinking about those sorts of behaviours and emergent behaviour and how that occurs in nature all the time. So, you know, you watch a flock of birds or a murmuration and you recognise it as that, but it's different every time and nothing's, you know, it's always shifting. And I think that sense of something being dynamic and evolving and always shifting is something that I'm also really fascinated by, and how that sort of can be thought about in many different kind of contexts, like even how an artist collective might, you know, function as a kind of non-hierarchical way of generating ideas and collaborative pieces. So yeah, ecosystems, I think.
Yes, you know, very much. And it actually reminded me of this piece of work that we did one time for Venn Music Festival, which is like listening to the world like an animal. Do you remember
that? Yes, yeah.
Where we created these sort of microphones that, well, I mean, it was translating essentially urban noise into the range of animals. But I was just going to say that some things like that are very characteristic of your work, where human sensing has limitations because we can hear in a certain range or we can feel through particular, you know, interfaces, aka skin or touch. But animals and other creatures of the world that we share have other capacities to sense. And some of your work then really looks to, I guess, expanding or revealing through an interface design or through an instrument how we can actually tune into what you sort of said is the invisible or the inaudible. How can you share a little bit about some of those techniques that you have developed over the years that have, I'm thinking particularly about, for example, hydrophones or horns. Mm-hmm. These are sort of reoccurring instruments in your work, for example. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, sort of, yeah, the hydrophone, I mean, I'm kind of really obsessed with hydrophone listening. And I've sort of over time tried out quite a lot of different hydrophones. And I'm particularly interested in sound artists or artists that make their own listening, you know, instruments. And I do also make hydrophones. And I think, I mean, it's a portal, it's a way in, some way of having an insight or a sense, or a way of sort of shifting your own perception. So I kind of also really like the way that all these different hydrophones have got different coloristic biases. So they're almost like instruments, and I kind of also see them as instruments or compositional tools. So on the one hand, it's a way into this potentially inaudible or hidden underwater world, but also, you know, sometimes making a composition by listening to four different hydrophones in the same space and kind of merging between them is another way of sort of, again, I guess, composing or imaginatively exploring this potentially usually inaudible sound world.
And with that, also bringing people into that kind of I guess, space of making. So some of your work looks at that through workshops, but also then the listening walks, for example, that you have been developing. Can you share a little bit about how they emerge or develop and what they entail?
I kind of realized that this, as I mentioned earlier, this kind of field recording and listening and shifting my perspective, I wasn't necessarily always using the recordings for anything afterwards. I mean, I have got like a lot of interesting recordings, but it's more the point of listening that I wanted to share with people and sort of bring people to. So the listening walks start, I mean, they actually started, well, the first watery listening walks I did were in 2015. And I was doing a project in Glasgow, and I got hold of this map of all of the sort of waterways. They're called burns, Scottish streams, burns, where they all are. And the fact that Glasgow was actually built on the Mollendina Burn, which is like a completely hidden waterway, not the River Clyde, as it, you might think, which is the huge river that goes through Glasgow. So I sort of got very interested in these kind of like natural veins that run through, originally were running through the landscape, that are kind of hidden or culverted or and I kind of wanted to get together with people local to those spots to sort of discover and listen to these streams together. So I've sort of diverted a bit into hidden waterways there, but this act of listening together became actually really a really amazing way of being together. So rather than me sharing these underwater sounds in a piece of music that is, you know, after the event of recording, to actually be there together and listen at the same time to, and it's a sort of a point of discovery, because when you throw a hydrophone in, you never know what you're necessarily going to hear. It could be, it changes all the time. So the listening walks are a way of bringing together a group of people to listen from different perspectives together. And I think, you know, often field recording you might do off on your own, so you've not got other people moving around or sounds, but I think actually I began to realize the importance of being together and listening together. And actually, the way that I do the walks now is everyone listens on wireless headphones, so I sort of throw in the different microphones and hydrophones and sort of fade between them, and we all listen together. And there's a real sense of people become very aware of actually the sounds that they're making themselves, and people tend to really slow down and listen for longer periods of time each time we kind of stop and sort of delve into another sound world. And it sort of really builds a bond between that group of people because of these moments of listening together to these from this other perspective.
I think it's really powerful because I mean I experienced some of your early, I would say, listening waterworks, and actually something that was very visceral that happened last night when I was walking around with a friend of mine in São Paulo was it's a city that it has not that many green spaces, and actually we walked across this massive road which actually used to be a river that got completely covered up. And it's a story in many cities where water courses have been diverted as we have sort of needed other trade routes, for example, or ways to move around a city. But this very kind of feeling that I had when I was moving across that river was, because it was a river, was actually how we have cut ourselves off from something that is, you know, so elemental, really, to our own sense of well-being and bodily relationships in space, and the fact that we are, you know, high concentrations of water ourselves, that actually to cut oneself off from that other sentient, lively flow is actually quite actually, I mean, I guess you could call it a form of violence in a sense, but probably not one that's maybe necessarily recognized in terms of actually the other so-called benefits that a road might bring or a cover-up might bring. And it really struck me that, you know, it's funny, we are going off on a tangent here, but actually I think it is very relevant to this sort of forms of active listening and quiet listening that often you speak about in your work as well. I throw
Yeah,
it
I
back
think,
to you.
no, absolutely. I think the thing in with these walks in Glasgow, we discovered where this particular these particular burns like went into a culvert and disappeared, and then we'd go and find where it came up. And all of that takes time, and it's those moments together where you're kind of discovering what you've just been talking about together slowly, and it kind of sinks in a different way than if you just look at a map or read a history about the river. Like the river in Bristol has got the motorway on top of it, the River Frome. I've done walks along that as well, and I think it's these realizations of sort of what we've lost from these over urbanized developments of where rivers are and rerouting them. And actually, as a result of some of the Glasgow work, there was then quite a lot of attention drawn towards daylighting some of these hidden burns. There was one running underneath a park. And I think more and more people are becoming more aware of what we've lost by covering up these rivers. And also, I was doing something at a National Trust park a few weeks ago, and there's a huge river running through this beautifully landscaped park. But also that river has been straightened over time to look like this classic landscape, and it needs to have like space to breathe. More and more so as the climate's changing and we're getting like more extremes of weather, our rivers need porous banks, and there's all these things that we kind of need to sort of start really thinking about, becoming aware of. And then I think as more and more people become aware of these things, there's like more actions taken or pressure put on to make changes that are going to bring these healthier ways of being with water. And
I think this ties very nicely as well to the other conversations that we had in this series, that we're speaking about the legal rights of rivers, or what does it mean to sort of speak on behalf of a water body, and the kind of activism, legal kind of work that's sort of happening there. Going forward a little bit with your work with rivers and I guess locations and specific locations, I know that over COVID you really got to kind of delve deep into your own local rivers. Could you share a little bit about that before we sort of get into how you've also worked with water as a mechanism in your installations, sort of moving from the listening and the walking to actually looking at the fluid dynamics of water? So first tell us about your little...
In lockdown, yeah. I had plans to follow the River Frome into Bristol with groups of people and to kind of get to know it as together with people who live very close to it. But of course, we couldn't really do those group things at that time. So I just actually started exploring this very sort of small area of the River Frome near my house. Every day I was sort of going to listen to it. And I think, again, this feeds into the rationale of wanting to do these listening walks, is that I really, really got to know it. All the different shifts and changes in levels, which plants were prominent at different times of year, and like what algae was where, and what birds were present, like dippers and kingfishers and herons, you know. It's like completely getting in tune with that ecosystem. But I wanted to sort of make a piece that somehow I started to get to know more of the kind of material qualities of the river through these interactions with listening. And it was also at a time when I was doing this fellowship around data and thinking about water data and ways of listening to rivers and, different environmental testing that you can do to sort of combine with that. But I also became quite interested in the messier sides of what was present, in this sense of like which different bits of algae were present, etc., etc. Anyway, I started to gather small amounts of this material and exposed it onto 16mm film in the back of my van as a kind of makeshift darkroom to try and sort of just share these kind of these shifts in material qualities of the river, and created a film that was basically a photogram film of sediment and algae and bits and pieces from the sort of qualities of that part of the river, which also then created an optical soundtrack, which created another way of listening. And again, it was just this wanting to engage in sort of very slow processes that have also got elements of indeterminacy and chance and something that I'm not completely controlling, a sort of some instability with that process of taking wet material and exposing it onto film.
And that those points around control, I guess, and agency, or tipping points, maybe, if we think about control and tipping points, one of your, I think, most stunning pieces of work is actually Tipping Point, which is a series of glass instruments. I mean, to actually try to visually, verbally describe, should I say, tipping point, does nothing to the richness of the work. So I'm going to maybe ask you to describe it and share with us what ways that water then became, and levels and changes became, a way through which both to create an installation and then a performance.
Yeah, I mean, it is quite difficult to describe without sort of seeing it, but I'll do my best. So, but basically, the origins of this piece, it was a similar, just before I was doing the walks in Glasgow, the listening walks. It was at a point where, I mean, the title's very loaded, Tipping Point, but it's quite an abstract piece. It's quite a sort of refined, I guess, abstract sculptural sound and light piece. I was thinking about extremes of water levels and how to draw attention to just a shifting body of water. So it works with pairs of glass vessels that share a body of water, and then there's a mechanical arm that lifts one up and pull and lets the other one drop. And as that process happens, because they're joined, the water flows into the lower one, and so just by gravity, one becomes full and one becomes emptier. And the sound is created by placing a microphone inside each glass vessel with a speaker external. So then you get a feedback tone that's tuned by that space. Essentially, it's tuned by the level of the water. So they're kind of codependent, which is an important part of the piece. But also, it's called Tipping Point as a, you know, nod towards climate tipping points, is that put that into people's mind. But also, the sound's made purely by audio feedback, which is also quite important part of the piece, because it's, I'm not actively making sound, I'm creating the conditions from which the sound emerges, and then the water levels actually act on the sound and change it. So there's this kind of, like, I guess, a kind of simple ecosystem between how all the different materials and mechanisms behave together. But also, there's an element of instability with audio feedback. I'm balancing it at the point of feedback, but I quite like this way that you have to kind of constantly unbalance it to create sound and balance it again. So there's this kind of dialogue between stability and instability, which causes the sound to emerge. And then they kind of affect each other with their feedback behavior as well. So that's, I guess, that's a description of the piece and some of the things that that are important about it. But I think the atmosphere that it creates is one where it's in quite a dark space, and there's audio activated lights inside each vessel, so you're kind of drawn to the sound through this light. And it's, again, it's, it gives, from observing people behaving inside the installation, people kind of slow down and get very focused. And then, as you're sort of observing and listening and watching and being in that space, there's a kind of gradual awareness about what's happening, but purely by focusing on these sort of codependent shifting water levels of one being full and one being empty, and then balancing when they're the same note.
I mean, there's these wonderful richness in your work, of course, that, you know, the te technical sophistication of the piece itself, the feedback loops, the ideas of ecological systems, of balance, of complexity, of material shifts, all of what you've just articulated there. Also, I think, having experienced many of your works, and participated in them and also worked with you, there's sometimes, I think, this nervous system shift that happens. And I just wondered if you have ever sort of, you've touched upon this, I guess, in terms of people slowing down and perhaps maybe even kind of regulating or moving in flock-like ways without necessarily being, like, conscious of it on one level. But does any of that kind of come into your thinking in a way? It's something I'm particularly interested in terms of what does it mean to calm the nervous system to a point that actually then we can make maybe another choice or another sense, another thing, or work in that gap between knowing and unknowing.
Yeah, I think it is definitely something that I'm searching for, and it's also a kind of counterbalance to the rest of my own life as well, which is, you know, can get really hectic. And I think I want to try and make these spaces that I know will, in me, instill this sense of slowing down and concentrating, and really expanding my thinking through this kind of sensory engagement, whether it be like listening underwater or being in that kind of space where you're focusing on water levels. And I think it's really important to make spaces like that for being together and thinking and sensing in these ways that we're not in an everyday way necessarily doing or we're losing touch with. Interestingly, when I show Tipping Point, I've just got this like dormant fascination with dowsing, and I want to learn how to douse. And I just, so many times when I've shown Tipping Point, I've either come across a dowser or it's cropped up or something's been pulling me in that direction. And these kinds of ways of sensing and being in the world that we have got inside us that we're not really in touch with anymore. Not that Tipping Point is helping me douse in any way, but just these kind of ways of being with these different, with water or with sound or with listening in these focused, concentrated ways. But also I'm quite interested in how it's possible to do that in quite abstract artwork. So with Tipping Point, there's nothing to say that people will read it in the same way. And I really like that ambiguity where you're kind of, yeah, the title is like really loaded. That's the only thing I'm really doing to sort of say, this is kind of where it's coming from for me, but not hugely explicitly. Like somebody once described them as lungs, like a like breath, and which, you know, I was really interested in.
Yeah, and they also kind of operate almost like quasi-scientific instruments or amplified scientific instruments in a space that are also then instruments themselves, because you both perform with them and they work in as an installation. And I guess that's another key characteristic of your work, that often the installations and the instruments that you actually create are ones that you perform with, which I guess is another headspace that you enter into.
Yeah, I think the performance, especially with something like Tipping Point, because it's 12 sets of these glass tubes that are, you know, hanging in it takes about person size, so this set of 12 of them takes up, you know, a whole room. So I'm kind of performing with this quite large distributed instrument of many parts, and it moves very slowly, so all I can do is mute or unmute a microphone or change the arm, whether it's tipping or not tipping, and then the behaviour of it emerges from that. So if I actually make a change, it won't be instant. I have to sort of listen and wait for the impact of that change to affect other things within the space. So what I like about that way of performing is it feels like a kind of conversation or a dialogue, or I'm not in control of it. It's got this emergent behaviour that I have to become very embedded within and sort of, yeah, have a conversation with. And I think that takes me into the kind of headspace that I need to be in to do that kind of improvisatory performance.
We're kind of coming a little bit close to the end of the conversation, and we started a few minutes late just because of you know, letting everyone settle in. But a couple of things that I wanted to sort of end with is, well, there's an obvious reference, of course, to much of your work around Pauline Oliveira's quiet activism, which has kind of got a lot of attention recently, I guess, in the last decade, for somebody who was sort of slightly obscured in a way. How important is that line of thinking?
Yeah, no, I mean, Pauline Oliveira is a really great inspiration. I was lucky enough to meet her in 2017, which was amazing. And so there's like her practice around these kind of open scores and sonic meditations, which I sort of really connects to this way of working with open scores and with ensembles and improvisation together. And then there's, of course, the practice of deep listening and becoming aware and tuning into all of the sounds around you and unfiltering your listening. And all of those ways that she articulates those ways of thinking, I do often reference and quote her on listening walks as ways of, you know, zooming into the sound furthest away from you, or, you know, those ways of sort of almost kind of making, tuning your listening so that you can kind of create a composition within just a process of tuning your listening into different parts of the soundscape around you. So, yeah, she's really important. And also these long-form improvisations and ways of working with time. And I think there are lots of other pieces that I work with where I'm trying to draw attention to processes like the formation of peat, or huge tidal ranges that are just beyond our human frame of reference. So thinking about deep time, long periods of time, and kind of planetary behaviours and systems that are kind of, you know, beyond our usual sort of frame of reference. And I think, you know, that's sort of present in how Pauline Oliveira sort of speaks about deep listening and these kind of long form improvisations.
And I think that work and your work and many of the artists that we've been speaking to actually links into this broader movement in the environmental humanities, environmental media, that is actually like trying to explore how we as humans tap into senses of deep time, because it's not something that we're actually really good at. We're very good at short-term thinking and not long-term thinking, but
yeah,
even
exactly.
our long-term thinking has been like 20, 25 years. It's not deep time thinking. And you know, you have these notions of time that are seven generations or seeds for the next group or something like this, that are kind of part of older wisdoms and indigenous knowledges, but not necessarily ones that we actually think about in our kind of contemporary society. So I just think that it's really beautiful to hear you reference that kind of deep time practices. Have you got a water body though that you really love, I have to say?
Okay, well, I've always loved swimming. I'm a swimmer, so I could go in many directions here, because you know, that relationship that I built with the River Froom in lockdown was so special. And that little bit of the river, whenever I go past it, I just have this, you know, moment of knowing. One of the most spectacular places I've swum is in the cenotes in the Yucatan region of Mexico, these incredible water-filled caves. But I actually have got some water recordings that I wondered if I could share with you at the end of the conversation.
I think it's quite a nice way to maybe kind of end the session, and just to say thanks to people for tuning in, and also to Kubu for hosting. And I'm going to hand over to Cathy Hind for bringing us out, fading us out with some watery tunes.
Okay, so I'm going to play, I spent 18 months working on a nature reserve in East Anglia called Wick and Fen. Hang on, I've just got to find the right file because I've got a lot of frog recordings open. where's the Wick and Fen one? There we go. And it's one of the only, I won't go on too long because we're finishing, but it's one of the only undrained fens in what could be considered a part of the English countryside that is an ecological disaster. But this place has been kept with very deep peat, and it's incredibly biodiverse. And this is just an unedited hydrophone recording that has got so many different species chirping and clicking away and bubbling and plants photosynthesizing, and it's constantly changing, and it's just like a wonderful piece of music. So I'll play that to you now. There we go.
Thanks to the fans. Thanks to the fans. Kathy, thank you so much for stepping
Thank
out
you.
from your busy day and busy week, and for sharing so much of, the touch points of your work. That's so rich. And also just a little shout out to our next session, which will be with Bryony Gillard on the 27th of August, who will also be working on the politics of wastewater through her practice as an artist. So please do join us. And thanks to everyone for tuning in. Please check out the Kubu website. Tumo's going to drop it into the chat. We have a call coming up in the coming weeks regarding air. If you would like to participate in our program, give us a shout out, and see you all in August. And for now, have a really nice summer. Thank you, everyone. Thanks, Kathy.